And I've been going back and forth between Haggai, Ezra, Zechariah, Ezra, you know, Chronicles, Ezra, Jeremiah, Ezra, Isaiah, Ezra. It's like everything is, this is, I tell you, one of those books that really, to really understand it, you have to do your homework in terms of going back and seeing where it's all coming from. How many of you, this is your first time with us since we started Ezra Nehemiah? Okay, great. If you don't have a copy of the intro notes, because I have a set of introductory notes that'll help you kind of get the background and you can, you know, during the week you can catch up with us. If you don't have those intro notes, what I'm going to do is, in between the sessions this evening, I will make some copies. So let me see who needs a set of those notes. One, two, three, four, five copies. Okay, I'll make six or seven just to play it safe. So I'll make copies of those things. All right, but let's just review before we go into chapters 2 and 3 tonight. And especially if you're taking notes, the events that we're reading about in these early chapters of Ezra are taking place in the 6th century BC, between the years 538 and 520. So I just want you to have a sense of when this is happening, okay? Going back a little further, in the 8th century BC, 722 BCE, is when the Assyrian kingdom invaded Israel. At the time, Israel was a divided monarchy, Israel in the north, Judah in the south. The Assyrians invaded northern Israel in 722 and carried our people away into captivity, repopulated the land with strangers and foreigners. And then a century and a half later, 587 BC, Babylon invaded the southern kingdom of Judah and took our people captive. But it really began in 605. People think of the Babylonian captivity as all sort of happening at once and lasting 70 years. The fact is it began in 605 when Nebuchadnezzar carried away the royal family and some of the nobles of the land. Then another wave in 597 when there was an attempted rebellion, and then again finally 587 or 586 BC when the temple was destroyed and Nebuchadnezzar basically leveled the city and took everybody pretty much captive. So so that was happening then. So now we're talking a full generation and a half later. It's roughly 70 years later. And this is when this is taking place. You may recall that Daniel in Babylon, of course now Persia, because Babylon has gone by the wayside after the fall of Belshazzar. Daniel, we find out, was reading in Jeremiah, and he realized that the 70 years God had decreed for the captivity was over. And so what did he do? He began praying and seeking God and confessing his sins and the sins of the people to God and seeking God. You know, it would be tempting to say, hey, 70 years are up. Come on, bring on the promise, send us back. But Daniel really sought the Lord. He didn't just assume, well, God said it, I don't have to do anything about it. That realization that the time was at hand caused Daniel to hit his knees in even a greater way than he normally did. This is a man who already prayed 3 times a day facing Jerusalem. But now he's realizing the time is at hand. How did he realize it? Because he had been reading Jeremiah. Wait a minute. But don't all the liberal theologians tell us, oh, Jeremiah was written much later, and how could anybody have known? And, well, Daniel had access to the prophet Jeremiah's scrolls while he was in Babylon. So it's a very narrow band of time comparatively. So again, as we come to Ezra, these early chapters, we're looking at the time from about 538 BC down to about 520 BC. And they didn't have cell phones. But if they did, they would have put them on mute. Ooh, make sure I turn mine off. Good, mine's off. All right. All right. And, you know, in a similar way that, Israel went into Babylon in three waves of captivity. The return was actually in three waves as well. So what we're going to read about here in these early chapters of Ezra is the first of three waves of immigration back to the land of Israel. And this one is under Zerubbabel. All right, and who made the decree? We find out in chapter 1, verse 1. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, this would have actually been Cyrus the Second, also known as Cyrus the Great, king of Persia. And his reign was from 559 to 530 BC. So what has he done? He has decreed, and we read this in chapter 1 last week, he has decreed for the Jewish people to be able to go back to their land and to rebuild their temple, and he is not just allowing it, he's encouraging it. We read in chapter 1, he said, let everybody whose heart stirs them go back, right? And that's exactly what happened. Everyone whose heart God was stirring to go back did that. They went back and to rebuild the city and rebuild the temple. And he's also basically fostered it through patronage. He's given money to help that happen. They took up a special offering just to see that that would happen. They gave them back all the articles of silver and gold and bronze that had been taken by Nebuchadnezzar from the temple all those years ago. And he gave orders concerning everything, including the lumber that was to be sent from Tyre and Sidon down to Judea. And you're thinking, wow, Cyrus, and he's talking about how the Lord, the God of Israel, and this and that, and you're thinking, wow, Cyrus, sounds like he might be a believer, but he wasn't. He wasn't. What we find out from the Cyrus cylinder, remember I showed you guys a picture of that cylinder? Basically a large clay vessel with what looks like Ugaritic writing across in rows. And what they would do is they would do it on clay and let it dry, and then coat it with a kind of ink, and then roll it across a parchment. And so they could make multiple copies of whatever they were doing. And they found this cylinder, which is one of the decrees of Cyrus. Turns out that he had actually been, for whatever reason, fostering the return of various people groups, all to go back to their own countries. It's like whatever Nebuchadnezzar had done, and Darius had kept in place, for whatever reason, Cyrus felt, I want to let people go back to their homes. And he apparently was fostering the building of religious shrines to all the various people's gods. So, and he talks about, in fact, in chapter 1, you look at the end of verse 3, let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. Cyrus wasn't a monotheist. He actually believed in the whole idea of local deities associated with cities, special locations. And so when he's giving honor to the God of Israel, it's not because he's like somebody like Naaman or even Nebuchadnezzar, who recognized that there is no other God except the God of Israel. He's just showing respect to what he considers to be all the local deities. You ever met somebody who had a chain around their neck and they had like 20 different amulets? They got the cross, they got the Mogen David, they got the hand, they got the Ankh, they got this, they got... It's like covering all their bases. That's sort of like what you got going on here. So I don't want you to get the idea that Cyrus is a monotheist. All right. Okay, and we talked about and we actually looked at prophecies from both Jeremiah and Isaiah that talked about it. In fact, Isaiah prophesied, I believe it was 186 years prior to Cyrus. Isaiah prophesied that a man named Cyrus would allow the Jewish people to go back and rebuild. Almost 200 years before. And, God's way of saying, I'm just going to show you that I'm God who speaks the things that aren't even yet. All right, now we come to chapter 2. I know that was a long review, but I won't need to do that next time because you'll just all have my notes. All right, so chapter 2, which we did look at last week, but I want to We're not going to read it verse by verse, but here's what we're looking at. We're given here in chapter 2 of Ezra the breakdown of those who returned. And here's what I want you to notice. We'll begin reading, and I want to show you that there's a certain breakdown here. Now, these are the people of the province who came up out of the captivity of the exiles, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away to Babylon and returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his city. These came with Zerubbabel, Yeshua, Nehemiah, Sariah, Re'aliah, Mordechai, Bilshan, Mispar, Bigvai, Rehum, and Ba'ana. And then you begin to have a breakdown. The number of the men of the people of Israel, the sons of Parosh, 2,172, the sons of Shephatiah, 372. We're not going to read all those numbers. What I want you to pay attention to is where it says at the end of verse 2, the number of the men of the people of Israel. We're going to see a threefold breakdown. In a Jewish community, people will ask, there's three basic divisions among the Jewish people. You're either a Kohen, a Levi, or a Yisrael. Okay? Kohen means that you are descended from the priestly line of Aaron. Okay? Descended from the line of Aaron. Anybody that you might know whose last name is Cohen? That means they're probably a Kohen. They're from the line of priests. There are other last names that give a hint of that as well. So there's Kohen, then there's Levi, those who are from the tribe of Levi, but they're not specifically from the family line of Aaron. Aaron was from the tribe of Levi, but he was the family line through which the priests, the Kohanim, those who went in and actually offered incense and made the sacrifices, the priests. But then you had the larger category of Levi. Now, out of all the 12 tribes of Israel, God gave to the tribe of Levi the privilege of serving in the tabernacle and the temple, performing the music and the liturgy associated with the worship at the temple during the time of the tabernacle, to take things down and pack them up and carry them away, and then to set it back up whenever, wherever we settle. So Levi, the tribe of Levi, was given that privilege. Can anybody tell me why the tribe of Levi, out of the 12 tribes, was given that privilege to have access to the temple and the tabernacle and all of its stuff? Millie, you want to give it a shot? Very good. You nailed it. Okay, you got it exactly right. At the time when Moses had been up on Sinai, receiving from God the commandments, he's gone 40 days, and what happens? Our people have like pretty much given up on him. They say to Aaron, "We don't know where Moses is. Forget it. Make us a god to go before us." And so Aaron, who's worried that everybody's going to kind of like turn on him, he capitulates. He says, "All right, bring me your gold." So everybody takes their earrings and they bring him all this gold, and he melts it down and he makes a golden calf. Sound familiar, right? Golden calf. And he says, "Here is your God, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." And it says the next day they summoned everybody for a feast. And it says they sat down to eat, and then it says they rose up to play. What do you think it's talking about? It's not talking about Mahjong. It's not talking about they decided to play Monopoly. They decided to have an orgy, a religious orgy, which would have been typical for that false kind of worship. Moses comes down off the mountain. He sees what's going on. He says to Aaron, "How could you let it get to this? What happened?" And Aaron gives the worst lie, most stupid, inane lie recorded in all of Scripture. "Well, the people gave me the gold and I threw it in the fire and out came this calf." Yeah, I really believe that one, Aaron. Anyway, he destroyed that calf, ground it to powder, threw it on the waters, made the sons of Israel drink those waters. And then he said, "Everybody who is part of this rebellion needs to be put to death." right? And 3,000 people ended up being put to death that day. But here's what he did. He drew a line in the sand, as it were, and said, whoever is for Adonai, come to me. And out of all 12 tribes of Israel, only the tribe of Levi rallied to him. And for that reason, also, I think in part, Pinchas, one of the descendants of Aaron, but it was because Levi stood with Moses and God on that day that God gave the tribe of Levi the privilege of serving in the tabernacle, to be near to him in that way. So, loyalty matters. Loyalty really matters. When the crowd is going this way, but the Lord and his standard is over here, you want to be over here, right? So, Levi gets the privilege. So, back to our text. In Ezra chapter 2, we're getting a breakdown of the people. You've got Am Yisrael, the people of Israel, but then you've got the Kohanim, the priests, and then we're going to see that there are the Levites. So, in chapter 2, verse 2, it talks about the number of the men of the people of Israel. And then we're given all the numbers. And I'm just going to assume that you guys are reading Ezra along with me as we go along. So there's no need for us to look at all the separate numbers. We're going to be given the grand total at the end. I want you to skip to verse 36 and notice something. And now the priests, or in Hebrew, Kohanim, the sons of Yediah of the house of Yeshua, 973, etc., Immer, sons of Pashur, the sons of Harim. You notice how short a list that is. Okay? What we would expect it to be short. These are specifically descendants of Aaron who are priests. So out of one tribe of Israel, then you have one family in that tribe, and then one man in that family, namely Aaron, and you have to be a descendant of Aaron to be a Kohen. So we would expect that section to be short. So there's not a lot of people there. All right, then verse 40, the Levites, the sons of Yeshua and Kadmiel, of the sons of Hodaviah, and we get a list there. There is a sub-list at verse 43, the temple servants. So we have like a subcategory of the Levites, the temple servants. Then you have in verse 55, the sons of Solomon's servants. These are also Levites, but they specifically served Solomon with regard to the building of the temple. And then verse 58, all the temple servants and the sons of Solomon's servants were 392. But there's something that happened in the midst of this. If you go to... Where do I have it here? Verses 61 to 63. Of the sons of the priests, the sons of Haviah, the sons of Hakoz, the sons of Barzillai, who took a wife from the daughters of Barzillai the Gileadite, and he was called by their name, these searched among their ancestral registration, but they could not be located. Therefore, they were considered unclean and excluded from the priesthood. The governor, by the way, that would be Zerubbabel, the governor said to them that they should not eat from the most holy things until a priest stood up with Urim and Thummim. What are Urim and Thummim? That's the casting of lots, essentially, to determine the will of God. So we do have certain families here that they couldn't locate, as it were, the hard copy. They couldn't find the record of their genealogy, or at least they didn't have the full genealogical ancestry to be able to show, yes, see, we are descendants of Aaron. And mind you, bear in mind that our people are just coming back from 70 years captivity. We went into exile for doing things wrong. We're coming back. We want to make sure we're doing things right. Okay, I mean, remember what happened with David with bringing the Ark of the Covenant? The first time he tried to bring it back to Jerusalem and it was handled the wrong way, and what happened to Uzzah and just the whole thing? we're just coming back from exile. We want to be doing things right. So rather than just to take people at their word, yeah, I'm a Kohen, do you have your ancestral records? We couldn't find it. Well, we can't let you serve among the priests without that proof. Zerubbabel came in and said, let them cast Urim and Thummim for them. Okay? Let one of the Kohanim cast the Urim and Thummim. It would have been something that the high priest actually wore as part of his breastplate. And let them cast it. And basically, God would show who was a priest. Again, just wanting to do things the right way. And if you think that's a little bizarre, just remember when we were looking for a 12th apostle to replace Judas, two men were put forward. Lord, who is your choice? And they cast lots, and the lot fell to Matthias. So, very common thing. So we've got this threefold breakdown. We've got the Yisrael, Am Yisrael, the people of Israel. We've got the Kohanim, the priests, and then we've got the Levi'im, the Levites. That's our breakdown. You notice that's like the first thing we get to in the book of Ezra? It's like the... I don't know if you're like me. I want to get to the action. I want to hear about this guy went here and he did this, and then this person came against him and they had the conflict and blah, 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 and here's how God intervened, and I want the action. What do we have here? Lists. Genealogies. Why? Specifically because, well, for two reasons. Number one is we're coming back and we need to know who are the priests, who are the Levites, because what's the whole point of coming back to Jerusalem if not to rebuild the temple and to get things going again? I mean, really, if it's just about real estate, I'd rather live in Yafo, up in the north, along the Mediterranean coast. It's not just about moving back home. It's about going back to rebuild the house of God. And so we would expect that there needs to be precision. Who's who can serve in the temple, and then beyond that, who can serve as priests. So it might seem, I don't know, an unnecessary list of details and numbers, but it's not unnecessary. We're not reading it all tonight for the sake of time, but it's there specifically that we might know that they were dotting their I's, they were crossing their T's, and God was watching and he cared, because they're going to rebuild the house of God. All right. And clearly it's a priority. Rebuilding the Mishkan was a priority. And so if you look at verses 64 and 65, we get our number. The whole assembly numbered 42,360. Besides their male and female servants, who numbered 7,337. We're including everybody, right? Everybody counts. And they had 200 singing men and women. Okay, they had a choir. It's great. The horses, camels, and mules, I don't care. But we're given those numbers. And you notice they're not rounded off, 10,000 of this, 20,000 of this. I mean, we have an historical record here. So now, before we go on to chapter 3, I want to do two things. Number one, just a reminder. Everybody who's named here, the total number ends up being 49,897. How many people of the nation of Israel went into captivity into Babylon? Hundreds of thousands. Who comes back? 42,000 and change. Why did so few come back? Because Babylon was a lovely place. And a whole generation had passed. And now they're speaking Persian. And they're comfortable there. And it's familiar. And they don't have to wonder where the next meal is coming from. Their families have been established there. It really took a pioneering spirit to be willing to leave what you had grown up with, what was familiar and beautiful and comfortable, and go to a place you've only heard about, but that you know for a fact is in ruins. And you're not going back to luxury, you're going back to hardship and to rebuild. happened again in the modern era with the rebirth of Israel. People went back and it was swampland. On the one hand, you had desert, just nothing. Then you had swamps, just malaria-infested swamps. It was a pioneer spirit. But if you were one of those people, your name is in here. Your family is listed here for all time. The book of Ezra isn't going away. You're remembered for all time as one of those who left the comfort and the familiarity of lovely Babylon at that time and went back to rebuild, to endure the hardship, and to start over. I think that's very cool. All right. Now, second thing. Who is this Zerubbabel? We read about Zerubbabel. Where's the first mention of him? I think he's mentioned there before that. 2:2. There's Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel is the governor. We find out elsewhere in Haggai 1:1, that Zerubbabel is the governor of Judah. But there's something else. Zerubbabel is the son of Shealtiel. Shealtiel was the son of Jeconiah. Why is this a problem? Look with me at Jeremiah 22. I'm going to create a dilemma and then I'm going to solve it for you. Jeremiah chapter 22. And it's important that I share this with you because as a fairly new believer in Yeshua, I had a rabbi challenge me and say, Jesus cannot be the Messiah. And we looked at Matthew together, and in the genealogy that Matthew gives us is this guy Jeconiah. He says, so what's the problem? And this rabbi says to me, you don't know? I said, what? He says, there's a curse on Jeconiah. None of his descendants could ever be king in Israel. I'm like, really? He goes, yeah. So he shows me Jeremiah chapter 22. I'm like, okay. So let's look at Jeremiah chapter 22. Jeconiah was a sellout. He sold out our people at our weakest ebb. Okay, we were being carried away into exile. The city was besieged. Jeconiah basically sneaks out. He's part of the royal family. He sneaks out to go to Nebuchadnezzar and lives basically in a palatial condition in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom and receives income from him and ate at his table and was shown all kinds of favor right at the time that our people were being slaughtered. Jeconiah was a sellout. And listen to what God says about him. Jeremiah 22:24. As I live, declares the Lord, even though Coniah, which is just a shortened form of Jeconiah, even though Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, even if you were a signet ring on my right hand, yet I would pull you off. And I will give you over into the hand of those who are seeking your life. Yes, into the hand of those whom you dread, even into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of the Chaldeans. I will hurl you and your mother who bore you, let me turn the page here, into another country where you were not born, and there you will die. But as for the land to which they desire to return, they will not return to it. Is this man Coniah a despised, shattered jar, or is he an undesirable vessel? Why have he and his descendants been hurled out and cast into a land that they had not known? O land, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, write this man down childless, a man who will not prosper in his days, for no man of his descendants will prosper sitting on the throne of David or ruling again in Judah. Now, in case you're wondering, you're thinking, why are you stirring up this pot, Rabbi Glenn? Turn to Matthew chapter 1. In Matthew chapter 1, the very first thing we have is a genealogy, which shows us the authentic Jewishness of Matthew. Start with a genealogy. But why is he giving us a genealogy right from the get-go? Because you don't get to square number 2 in terms of claiming to be the Messiah if you don't fulfill square 1 and show that you are truly a descendant of David through the right lineage. Because anybody can come along and say, I'm the Messiah, and have a very charismatic personality, and people will follow them. It's happening to this day. But to the Jewish people of the first century, you come along and you say, I'm the Messiah, first thing they're going to say is, let's see the credentials. And by credentials, they mean, let's see your ancestral lineage. Your yichus is the Yiddish word we use. Let's see your yichus. Let's see you show us that you have the credentials genealogically to make it. So Matthew starts out with a genealogy. Now think about it. What's his purpose? To establish right out of the gate that Jesus is the rightful Messiah of Israel. So you've got to have the genealogy right there, right from the get-go. But look what happens when we get to verse 12 of this, or verse 11. Josiah became the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. After the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah became the father of Shealtiel, Shealtiel the father of Zerubbabel. Hold on a minute. Jeconiah? This is the guy we just read about in Jeremiah 22. God says none of his descendants will sit on the throne of David. Like, oh my goodness. So I'm left with a couple of possibilities here. Matthew is either a complete idiot for including something like that when you're trying to establish credentials, or something must have happened along the way because this is the first thing everybody's going to check. And if they can eliminate Yeshua's claim to be the Messiah on the basis of a bad ancestry, that's their first line of attack. They don't even have to mess with his teachings or question what he's doing on the Sabbath or any of that if they can just disprove him on the basis of a bad genealogy. So do you get what the dilemma is? Jesus is descended from Zerubbabel, who's descended from Jeconiah. And God has pronounced a curse on Jeconiah and his line. What do we do about that? I told you I was going to resolve the dilemma. Take a little bit of a left turn and go to Haggai. We're going to be spending some time in Haggai in the weeks ahead, God willing. Now, Haggai, the context is basically God is encouraging the people. Because they started to build, right? They put the foundation of the temple, and then there were obstacles. Opposition came, false accusations and threats. And it's like, oh man, is this ever going to get done? And we want to worship the Lord. All we've got is this, like the foundation, just like the floor. The floor, that's it. And God is saying, don't be discouraged by that. Don't be discouraged. He's encouraging the people, look, you've built your homes, now it's time to build my house. And so at Haggai chapter 2, look at verse 20 and following. It's right before Zechariah. Okay. Haggai 2:20. Then the word of the Lord came a second time to Haggai on the 24th day of the month, saying, speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I'm going to shake the heavens and the earth. I will overthrow the thrones of kingdoms and destroy the power of the kingdoms of the nations. And I will overthrow the chariots and their riders and the horses and their riders will go down, everyone by the sword of another. But now look what he says in verse 23. On that day, declares the Lord of hosts, I will take you, Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, my servant, declares the Lord, and I will make you like a signet ring. For I have chosen you. See what's happening? That same expression. I'm going to make you like a signet ring. I took it off once. I'm putting it back. God has reversed the curse. He's lifted the curse on the line of Jeconiah. So that Shealtiel, his son, is accorded honor. Zerubbabel, his grandson, is accorded honor and becomes the governor. So God, by using the same exact expression of a signet ring, is restoring the line. Now, why is that significant? Because, again, in the first century, when people are looking at Matthew's genealogy, they see Jeconiah. All anyone had to do is raise a ruckus about Jeconiah. But you notice that the complete silence in all four of the Gospels about Jesus' genealogy, right? The Pharisees, who were looking for any excuse to discredit him, did they ever come to him and say, you have the wrong genealogy? I mean, that would have been the first line of attack. And if Jaconi is in there, and they know it, and Matthew knows it, and everybody knows it, why isn't it a problem? Because everybody knew that through the prophet Haggai, God had lifted the curse. All right? Just wanted you to have the whole picture. Because that rabbi who threw that objection to me, I don't know if he knew about Haggai 2:23. I don't assume that rabbis are necessarily biblically literate. But if he did, this is what you call half the truth. And that's why in a court of law, we tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. There's the rest of the story. All right, well, here's what we're going to do. We'll come back in just a few minutes to go through chapter 3 of Ezra. At this point, introduce John Erdman to you. John, come on up here. Most of you know Dave and Nadine. John is their nephew. And John was with us, what was it, about a year ago?
Through my uncle, I was with you.
Yeah.
That's right.
It was a while ago. But anyway, John's been serving.
And I was at Sukkot, yeah.
Yeah, he was at Sukkot. And serving in India for a while, right, with Crew.
That's right.
Campus Crusade. And God has put it on his heart that he is to go full time. Anyway, so I wanted him to be able to have some opportunity to tell us about what he's going to be doing and how that's going to look and maybe how we can get involved. So I told him I'd give him about 15 minutes, and then what we'll do is we'll take a break like we always do between classes. If you want to talk to John, I encourage that. And then we'll come back. The second half of tonight's class will be about 30 minutes. And then, again, John will be here if you'd like to talk some more with him. So now, I know some of you have to leave after the first hour. So those of you who are going to be leaving, I encourage you to talk to John during the break. And then those of you who know you're going to be staying for the second session can talk to him after that second session. So, John, I turn it over to you. And we're back. Welcome to the second session for the Shema Bible study, those of you who are here and those of you who are listening online. Okay, we're going to pick up in Ezra chapter 3. And I would say chapter 3 will probably take about 20 minutes, not a whole long time. Again, I do encourage everybody to be reading Ezra and then Nehemiah and Haggai on your own, kind of keep up on your own. But we're going to read chapter 3. And unlike chapter 2, which had the listings and the numbers, chapter 3 actually gets down to the business of rebuilding, or at least the beginning of it. And so let's look at Ezra chapter 3. And every so often I'm going to make a really abrupt stop. And some of you will be wondering, why did you stop in the middle of a sentence? Others of you, especially those of you who have been at Shema for a while, are going to probably know full well why I make those hard stops. Now, when the seventh month came, stop. Seventh month, the month of Tishrei. The seventh month on the Jewish calendar is the highlight of the whole year. Because in the seventh month, we have the three fall festivals. The Feast of Trumpets, Festival of Trumpets, called Yom Teruah, or what it's called today is Rosh Hashanah, the new year, or the head of the year. It's the civil new year, not the religious new year, because the religious new year begins with Passover. But still, the seventh month, seven is so important in Jewish thinking. And there are seven annual holidays in the Jewish calendar. And the last three of them all fall in the seventh month. And the third one of them lasts 7 days. So it's obviously very significant. That's why I stopped when the seventh month came. By the way, where did the Jewish people get their own calendar? The calendar that Jewish people use today is the calendar we adopted from Babylon. So the names of the months in the Jewish calendar, Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, Tevet, Shvat, Adar, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, these are mostly Babylonian names. Tammuz was a Babylonian deity. But it's not as though Jewish people are being pagan. It's just names that came down from Babylon. But we adopted the Babylonian calendar. And so the seventh month is now called the month of Tishrei. And as we know from Leviticus chapter 23, and also from Deuteronomy chapter 16, three times a year, all Jewish men were supposed to come up to Jerusalem, right? Passover, and also at Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, right? 50 days later. And then Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. So the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot, is in the seventh month. It's the seventh holiday. So think about this. The Jewish people are now back from captivity. We're back in the land. But again, you had to be a pioneer kind of spirit because it was desolate. We came back to rebuild. So again, chapter 3, now when the seventh month came, and now you understand why that phrase is really special. Now when the seventh month came and the sons of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered together as one man to Jerusalem. Then Yeshua, the son of Jozadak, and his brothers, the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brothers, arose and built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. They don't have a temple yet, but they set up the altar. Now think about it. On the one hand, you might think, how could they do that? They haven't built the temple. Where do they get off building the altar? Remember what Jesus said? He said, it's not the temple that sanctifies the altar, and it's not the offering, it's the altar that sanctifies the offering. So they didn't have to have the big building. They built the altar in the appropriate place. And where is the appropriate place for the altar? Where was the temple? On the very site where Abraham offered Isaac up in Genesis chapter 22, and God stopped his hand. But it was at that very place. And so they built the altar. And that's legit. God didn't say in Leviticus 23, offer these offerings only after you build me a nice fancy building. He didn't say that. We didn't have a fancy building. We had a tent, right? So they built the altar, and it's completely legit. Verse 3, so they set up the altar on its foundation, for they were terrified because of the peoples of the lands. And they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord. Burnt offerings morning and evening. And it says they set up the altar on its foundation, for they were terrified because of the peoples of the lands. There's a couple of different ways to look at it. It could be that they're offering these offerings to the Lord at the appropriate time, but their hearts are trembling because people are starting to conspire. As we're going to find out in Nehemiah, there were a whole lot of people who were not happy about the regathering of the Jewish people and the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem, let alone the temple. They had enemies. They had people who didn't want to see that happen. So there's that aspect of they were terrified. And the other way of looking at it is that they set up the altar without having built anything yet, because they didn't want to provoke anything, since there was still some controversy about it all. Not sure. There's a couple of views on that. But let's go on. In any case, they built the altar. They offered the sacrifices. They're where they need to be. They're there when they need to be, in the seventh month, on the first of the month, the Festival of Trumpets, right? And they're doing what they need to be doing. They're offering the prescribed offerings. And think about it. It's Kohanim. It's priests offering those sacrifices, about whom we just read. So in other words, we've come back to the land, and we're not perfect, but we're doing our best to do it right. The right people, at the right time, in the right manner, in the right place. All right. Let me go on. Verse 4, they celebrated the Feast of Booths, right? Sukkot, Tabernacles. as it is written, and offered the fixed number of burnt offerings daily according to the ordinance as each day required. Now, I'm going to try something here. Or actually, my phone is turned off. Anybody whose phone is on still and they're willing to admit it? Does it have a calculator function? Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to ask you to do something for me, Kevin. Okay. Get to the calculator and start out with the number 14. Then add 13 to it. Then add 12 to that. Then add 11. And I want you to take it all the way down to 1 and tell me what the total number comes to. So we're starting at 14, again, a multiple of 7, which is the perfect number. Start with 14 sacrifices and reduce it down each day. And tell me what we get. 105 from 14? Okay, then let's do it this way. I shouldn't have had you go all the way down to 1. Add 14 to 13, and then add 12, then add 11, then add 10, then add 9. What do you have so far? 69. Whose calculator do I trust? Well, in any case, the way it worked out is, I don't know exactly how it was worked out, but beginning with 14, it ended up being 70 sacrifices. Because you had the 7 days, then there was an 8th day, there was one more sacrifice. So 69 plus 1, 70. Again, a multiple of 7, but more significantly even than that, according to the rabbis and according to ancient tradition, 70 was considered to be the number of the nations of the world. Now think about this. We're celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles, where everybody comes, like the imagery, coming under God's tent, right? And there's 70 sacrifices if you add the 7 days plus the one sacrifice on the 8th day, because there's an 8th day of assembly for Sukkot. You get 70 sacrifices. What's the implication? There's room under God's sukkah, his booth, for people from every nation. It's a beautiful picture. Okay? Just wanted to throw that out to you. All right. So again, verse 4, they celebrated the Feast of Booths as it is written and offered the fixed number of burnt offerings daily according to the ordinance as each day required. And afterward, there was a continual burnt offering also for the new moons and for all the fixed festivals of the Lord that were consecrated, and from everyone who offered a freewill offering to the Lord. From the first day of the 7th month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord. But the foundation of the temple of the Lord had not been laid. In other words, they just have the very framework. Even the foundation is not done yet. Okay? So I want you to get a sense that this is really humble beginnings. They've come back and there's nothing. Everything had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, burned with fire. The walls of the city are in ruins. It'd be like going to an archaeological excavation today and there's stones and there's pieces of a wall, and right? That's all there's there. And they have to come back and they've got to rebuild. And now it's the 7th month, the month of the great festivals, including the Feast of Tabernacles, right? And they haven't even finished the foundation of the temple. And I'm sure they're all feeling a mixture of joy and sadness at the same time. Joy because we're back and we're celebrating the festivals. And yet, look at the condition of the city of Jerusalem, the city of God. So I'm sure just kind of mixed feelings about all of it. Verse 7. Then they gave money to the masons and carpenters and food and drink and oil to the Sidonians and to the Tyrians, to bring cedar wood from Lebanon to the sea at Yafo, or Joppa, according to the permission they had from Cyrus, king of Persia. Tyre and Sidon, does that sound familiar? Wood coming down from Tyre and Sidon? When did we read about that? Solomon's time. King Hiram of Tyre and Sidon, and especially Tyre, King Hiram had been a friend of Solomon. He had been a friend of David, and then when Solomon became king, he supported him and encouraged him. Solomon was the one who was going to build the temple. And what did Hiram do? Up in Tyre and Sidon on the north, the far north Mediterranean coast, they were experts in wood cutting and carving and carpentry. Hiram sent him just oodles and caboodles of cedar, pre-cut cedar, and sent it all to Solomon. And so when you read about this, we're supposed to call that to mind, because it was the Tyrians and the Sidonians through Hiram that sent all that wood down. Now, Hiram's long gone, as is Solomon. And so now it's not being given as a gift. They had to pay for it. But just the same, there's this parallel. It was the great cedar wood from Tyre and Sidon that came down when Solomon built the temple. And now we're importing that beautiful cedar wood again to rebuild. So there's encouragement there. And it says, to bring cedar wood from Lebanon to the sea at Yafo. Joppa is how we get it in English, but the Hebrew is Yafo. You know what Yafo means? Lovely. Beautiful. And we were in Yafo when we were in Israel. And I'm telling you, it is a beautiful, beautiful city. You're going to be seeing pictures of it probably in about 2 weeks. I'm going to be showing you pictures. You're all going to want to sell everything you have and move to Yafo. I'm telling you, it's so beautiful. All right. Verse 8, now in the second year of their coming to the house of God at Jerusalem in the second month, Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua, the son of Jozadak, and the rest of their brothers, the priests and the Levites, and all who came from the captivity to Jerusalem, began the work and appointed the Levites from 20 years and older to oversee the work of the house of the Lord. Let's hold on a minute. In the second year? You're telling me the whole year has gone by and now we're into the second year? Yeah, there were a lot of obstacles. And it was not an overnight process. I'm amazed at that when I see how quickly houses go up these days. It makes me a little suspicious. Is our technology really that much better? Or does it seem like that house wasn't there last week? I think we do have a lot better technology, truth be told. But in any case, it takes time to do this. So now they're in the second year of the return. They're in Jerusalem. It's the second month. And they're beginning the work in earnest now. Verse 10. Now when the builders had laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests stood in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the son of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise the Lord, according to the directions of King David in Israel. They sang, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, saying, for he is good, for his loving kindness is upon Israel forever. Ki le'olam chasdo. It's Psalm 136. It's just a refrain that repeats again and again for all that he's done. He is good, his loving kindness is upon Israel forever. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. Now, this is just the foundation, okay? It's not the whole shebang. It's essentially the footprint and the foundation stones and just like that very first layer. So this is not impressive. This is just right at the beginning. But look what happened. All the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. Verse 12. Yet many of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers' households, the old men who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, while many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the shout of joy from the sound of the weeping of the people, for the people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard far away. So some people are going, this is so great! The temple's being rebuilt! This is wonderful! And others are going, this is awful! This is nothing like the temple our fathers had! But all anybody's hearing is, yeah! And so the people who remembered Solomon's temple and how grand it was, they saw the footprint and they said, oh, this is just nothing like the glory days. But it's important to note that that a ceremony marked, worship marked the completion of that foundation. You know, the idea that whatever we're doing for the Lord, we don't just run on and do it. We bathe it in prayer. And when we come to a milestone, we memorialize it. We worship. That's what Abraham did when he came to that place. And God made that covenant with him in Genesis 12, right? And then he would reiterate it to him. And every time Abraham built an altar to the Lord, the idea of memorializing a special breakthrough, a turn of events, or the completion of something significant for God. You memorialize it with a time of worship. Recently, the CareNet Pregnancy Center that I've been serving at in Berkeley, we bought a building in Detroit because we want to expand the ministry into Detroit. It's now being almost done being retrofit. It's almost ready to go. When we bought the property and the closing went through, we had a worship service there. It's always right to memorialize when you're doing something like that in the Lord, and you've come to a milestone, to stop, to give thanks, to worship, to make a big deal of it, to make a big deal of it. Now, I don't know if Shema will ever have our own synagogue. I mean, I love it here. The people here at Bloomfield Hills are just terrific. They love us. They really do love us. Pastor McKay, if he's told me one time, he's told me 20 times, Glenn, I can't wait till we're financially in a position to not have to charge you one penny of rent. We just love you and we're glad you're here. I mean, he's told me that so many times, and he means it. But I'd be lying if I said it'd be nice to have our own synagogue. So if any of you know a Roman centurion, I'm looking for a Roman centurion to build us our synagogue. We can pray for that. It's not wrong to want to be able to do that. Will it happen? I tend to think the end is nearer than farther, and you know, so I'm okay either way. But if we do end up with our own place, you've got to know that it's appropriate and right to memorialize these things, and it's not restricted to buildings. To mortar and brick. Has God brought you to a new place in your life? Maybe he's brought you to a new job, a new home, a new location, a new understanding of certain things. It's right to memorialize it, to worship at a time like that. Linda. Yeah, just to be back in the land. I can't tell you, when Alexander and I were on this trip to Israel recently, and Eileen could tell you the same thing. And Eileen was there 2 years ago, right? 2 years ago? Oh, 5 years ago. Doesn't matter. You get there and your heart just overflows. It's just like, I'm here. I'm in the land again. You're right. You're right. Here's something even just as cool as that. You notice it mentions that the old men who had seen the previous temple were kind of weeping about it. Old men made the journey back from Babylon to a place of ruins and were among those who rebuilt. Old men. Oh, we'll let the young whippersnappers do that. I'm comfortable here in Babylon. You know, I've hit retirement. Got a condo by the Euphrates. Yeah. It'd have been easy to do that. Young and old alike, whoever's heart God was stirring to go up and to go back and to rebuild the ruins. My prayer, Lord, give me a heart like that. Let me never get so comfortable that my first love isn't to go back to the land. My first love isn't to be there, you know, to rebuild. Yeah, so. And in terms of just the fact that it's much smaller footprint and it's very humble, I was reminded of Zechariah, and I'll just read this to you. Don't turn there because I don't want you to lose the beauty of these words by looking while I read. I just want to read this to you. The word of the Lord came to me, saying, "The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house, and his hands will finish it. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you, for who has despised the day of small things? But these seven will be glad when they see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. These are the eyes of the Lord which range to and fro throughout the earth." Let's not despise the day of small things. You know, it's from just such small beginnings that God has shaken the world. Amen? Lord God, thank you for our time together this evening. Thank you for your word. Thank you for the regathering of the Jewish people then and now. And help us, Lord God, to remember Eretz Yisrael. And as the psalmist wrote in Psalm 137, you know, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, if I do not allow Jerusalem to be the chief joy in my life. And so, Lord God, help us to be like those halutzim, those pioneers. Help us always to have hearts that are stirred to do the work you're calling us to, wherever and however it's to be done. We thank you so much for our gathering this evening. Please give everybody safe travels on their way. In Yeshua's name. Amen. Encourage you, if you want, stick around and talk to John and find out a little bit more about what he's going to be doing and support his ministry.